Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
Devinder Hardawar and Christopher Bernard are out this week, so it's just you and me, Dwayne. On this week's show, we're going to examine social media's reaction to the tragedy in Aurora, plans to relaunch Dig, why a buyout of your favorite startup means it's probably toast, and why you're going to need all new dock connectors for your Apple devices. So, usually when we start the show, we like to talk about what we've been playing with this week. And we hadn't actually pre-discussed this in advance, so I'm just asking you blindly, Dwayne, what you've been playing with, or if there's anything that you'd like to talk about that you've been playing with.
I am redoing my media situation in my entertainment space in my home. So, and by that I mean I don't have a big apartment. It's fairly small because we're in Boulder and it's not very cheap, and because we don't want to really like commit just yet. So I've got my Sony sitting on top of a media cabinet that was, I think, originally designed for VHSs. We got it used, and it's awesome. It's reclaimed wood. It's everything. But I've drilled a couple holes in the top in order to get the heat out from, like, you know, the wireless G hotspot and some of the other devices down there. I have a Mac Mini down there. And now I'm actually going to cut out a little hole in the back for a 120-millimeter fan and a fan guard, which is going to catch the dust. And I'm actually going to attach a temperature sensor, so it's only going to go off once it hits a certain temperature. Mm-hmm. And I have an analog speed device. So it goes power to Molex to temperature sensor to analog speed device to fan. Because I don't want the fan to go off full blast even when it's on. It's just supposed to evacuate air, so it sucks air through the front.
Because all those combined components can really generate quite a bit of heat back there.
Yeah, that's really what happens. I mean, it's in the cabinet. The cabinet is, you know, it's not a small cabinet, yeah. But at the same time, it does get a little warm in there, especially when the Mac Mini's in there with the WRT54G greatest router in the world that I now use as a hotspot for my older devices. So basically my iOS, my iPhone 3GSs that I use as like remote controls and stuff, those are using that. And it gets warm in there. So I pump the heat out the back is the idea. And I also got a trip light. This is my big purchase for the week. Mostly it happened because my girlfriend was away, so she can tell me not to buy it. But it's a trip light 850 VA Eco UPS. And what it does is I'm going to attach, you know, the TV and everything to it. And it turns off those items that are on standby. Like, it can tell that they're on standby because of the amount of electricity they're using and how consistently they're using it.
So you don't get that vampire. What do they call it? Vampire?
The vampire. Yeah, the vampire effect where you're spending electricity on stuff that's not even on.
Right.
And so I'm going to play with it. I don't really know exactly how it lets me, like, use my remote control on stuff that's, like, been turned off by them. I think it mostly what it does is it has a periodic turn-off period. And it turns it kind of back, like, lets it go back into standby. But we'll play with it and we'll see exactly what it's going to be doing. But the big deal is that I need my my routers and stuff and the Drobo that I plan on buying this year to be on a UPS.
It's your first Drobo?
It's my first Drobo. And the reason why it's my first Drobo is because I was waiting until it had its own built-in battery backup.
Oh, uh-huh.
And it has now a built-in battery backup where the minute the battery is engaged, the system uses the battery time to properly shut itself down.
Oh.
So you don't brick any hard drives, which is huge for me.
To say that I was an early adopter on Drobo, and I almost wish I hadn't been because they've made so many more advancements with the technology, and the new Drobos now are just exponentially better than those first models. But on the other hand, I have gotten a lot of use out of it in the time since I've owned it, so I'm glad that I've had it. I just wish basically what boils down to is I'd love to get another one, but I can't afford it.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're going to drop that 800 bones, whatever, I'm looking at the new version of the S when it comes out.
Yeah.
It's going to have, it has that battery backup solution. I want to see if I, you know, it's going to run the Beyond RAID on it, all that stuff. I've got a stack of 2 terabyte hard drives that are ready to be used for the thing. So I'm just excited about that. But yeah, the idea is to kind of, you know, right now I have some power saving, what are they called? Power saving power strips mm-hmm. that I've been using. Like, for instance, when I walk out the house, I hit a couple switches and the power strips turn off completely. And that's all well and good. I just, you know, I'm trying to level up now. So
I hear you.
What are you playing with?
Well, I'm still kind of having a honeymoon effect from last week's Steam summer sale. And I bought a couple of, you know, usually for whenever Steam has these seasonal sales, I spend a lot more money than I expect to. And it sneaks up on you because it's like $4 here, $5 here. And then pretty soon you've got a lot of money invested in these games. And I bought a couple of new games other than the couple of ones that I discussed last week. And they were Driver San Francisco and Alan Wake. And Driver San Francisco, I can't say that I'm really that thrilled about, because the PC version is unfortunately hobbled by the controls, which is basically just the arrow controls for a driving game. And there's nothing worse than trying to play a driving game with just arrow controls. It's ridiculous.
That's true. That's true. Unless it's Star Wars Episode I Racer, because that actually works really well.
Oh, really?
I mean, that game is from 1998, in case people are too young to remember it, but that was a great game with controls.
But the other game, Alan Wake, is really good. I'm surprised. Actually, it's one of those games that I had heard maybe middling reviews when it first came out mm-hmm. and was on the fence about, and now that it has finally, I mean, now that it's on sale and I've spent maybe $5 on it, and I've played it, I realize it's really good. It's from the developers of the original Max Payne.
Max Payne, yeah.
Yeah, Remedy games. Yeah. And it's basically like a really dark sort of detective horror story, and it's...
Oh, okay. Does Mark Wahlberg play the main character?
No. But it's framed like you're watching an episodic detective show. So you get these chapters and episodes, and then every time a new episode comes up, you get that previously on Alan Wake, and they show you a recap of what the previous chapter...
That's nice. That encourages you to, like, kind of stop at the chapters.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You get that replay.
Right. So that's what I've been playing with. Shall we get into some headlines here?
Headlines. I'm all about it.
Okay, so right off the bat, a tragic headline takes us into our first story. Last Friday, July 20th, in Aurora, Colorado, a masked gunman walked into a movie theater where a midnight screening of The Dark Knight Rises was underway. He shot into a crowd.
The opening midnight screening.
That's right, opening screening. He shot into the crowd with multiple firearms, killing 12 moviegoers and injuring 58 others in what is now the largest mass shooting in U.S. history. Now, we've often discussed the growing presence of social media on breaking news here on The Drill Down, and in particular, in the wake of cataclysmic or world-changing events. In 1999, when two high school seniors went on a shooting spree in Columbine, Colorado, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube didn't exist. Those desperate for updates had to keep their eyes glued to major cable news networks. And here I'm quoting a little bit from this Time article. Soon after news of the Aurora shootings began surfacing, Reddit users began contributing to a post called Comprehensive Timeline Aurora Massacre, a crowdsourced account of what happened in Aurora as posted by user Integer, who was later identified as 18-year-old Morgan Jones from the Denver area. You'd be hard-pressed to find a more complete minute-by-minute breakdown of the shooting. It includes links to news stories, tweets, YouTube videos, audio from emergency responders, statements from government officials, and more. This is what Reddit offers readers that major media organizations never can. You can't ask a witness in a newspaper story how he felt during a disaster or offer condolences to someone you see on cable news. Is everything you read on Reddit true? No, but as Redditors like to point out again and again, neither is everything you see on the nightly news or read in the newspaper. But no news organization or social media site currently offers an experience as concurrently as immediate, engaging, and thorough as the one offered in this case by Reddit. The crowdsource model of disseminating information is, for better or worse, now part of how we experience news of traumatic events in this country. And I thought this was a really fascinating case because we'd talked about before when there were global floods or other disasters, how quickly Twitter and other social media sites have responded quicker than cable news, quicker than any other news source. And, you know, with that, there's a little give and take about accuracy. But for the most part, in general, they tend to be fairly accurate. But this is the first time that a social news aggregator of Reddit's
paradigm.
Of basically Reddit's style of social news aggregator has been so quick and so comprehensive, and it basically came down to one particular source from one user who was doing all this legwork of aggregating all of these different news accounts from all over the place into one thread. And I thought that was a really fascinating case. I don't know if you had a chance to see this.
I mean, the way I look at it, I mean, I'm in Colorado, obviously. Sure. I'm in Boulder. I don't go to that theater. It's really far away from where we are because we're in Boulder. But Twitter is amazing when it comes to getting multiple reports, but someone has to aggregate them. The Wikipedia has often been amazing when breaking news has happened because the trusted editors can go in there and link to the stories and put together a cohesive story that are out there. But Reddit has the unique position of being a news aggregator that's social, and it allows for stories to be told from people. And what you get in Reddit or any social way of aggregating news is even if there are people who are going to be untrue, the overriding majority of people are not. Mm-hmm. So it's going to balance out leveraging toward the truth, because that many people can't have a conspiracy about that kind of thing.
Right.
And not in real time anyway. So, I mean, I think we're all impressed, but this week in Colorado, there's been a lot of talk about how this tragedy is definitely a tragedy, but you know, guns are part of freedom and freedom and all this other stuff, because it's Colorado and that happens. They talk about guns and how they're part of freedom. What I think is, when I look at this story, when I read this story, when I understand what was going on Reddit and other crowdsourced social media, that's the freedom. This is freedom at work. It's people working together to get the story out there, to have people understand exactly what's going on. It's actually, in some ways, what I think journalism has been missing. And it's ironically, you know, it was fueled by, I guess, what we can call an individual reporter.
Right.
Mr. Jones, Morgan here, 18 years old, took it upon himself to continually update everything that he knew from being in there. And I think that offers a sense of catharsis to the people who are attached to the people who are there. I know that if this kind of thing were happening during 9/11, when my city was being attacked, I would have been in a much better place than I was. And I'm not saying this is 9/11. I'm not even saying this is Columbine. This is its own thing. But it is one of those things that touches the nation. And to me, what was really effective about this is the fact that Reddit was able to be used by all these people to this end. And they were able to get it, you know, they were able to figure out how to use it effectively and usefully. And I think this is where news kind of needs to go. Like, you have this crazy, crowdsource. And then perhaps the reporter, the journalist, perhaps their job is to focus on curation rather than curation and possibly editorial work, rather than this idea that investigative journalism has to happen from someone who's been to journalism school, who's, you know, been in the field, whatever. Like, news happens where things happen, and we can't always expect a journalist to be there. So I don't know. I was impressed by this, and I think it's where the future needs to head, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly the same thing. I mean, what makes this so unique is I've never seen anything like it, quite like this before.
It's not quite like this. That's the cool thing. It's there's a lot of stuff that's similar. Yeah, Twitter with the, you know, with the Iranian stuff, and like, you know, Wikipedia with this person who just died suddenly, like, you know, whoever it was, Michael Jackson or Whitney Houston or whatever. But Reddit, this was like, it was like a thing. It was like
Right, and it's I mean, one person took it upon themselves, and I really do hope that this is an example for future incidents like this. Unfortunately, tragic incidents like this, and it's just a great kind of a great touchstone for the future of citizen journalism, I think.
Yeah, and I really think that what all it needs. For those naysayers out there saying, oh, these people, they don't know what they're doing. All it really needs is some level of, like, curation. Like, you know, Reddit, when it sees that this is truly a breaking story, this is truly breaking news, get a curator on there, have some fact-checking going on where they can, you know, that kind of thing, and just kind of focus on that.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on here. BetaWorks, Digg's new owners, announced on their blog that news.me, their application, are taking over Digg and turning it back into a startup. They say they're rebuilding it from scratch. In 6 weeks, on August 1st, after an adrenaline and caffeine-fueled period, News.me plans to roll out a new version 1, taking the first steps towards remaking Digg. They say the old Digg infrastructure was expensive and it afforded us little latitude to innovate and build at a fast clip. So 4 weeks ago, we set an aggressive goal to move to a new infrastructure by August 1st. We're starting with a fresh code base. It's modern, fast, and shiny and new. And the thing about their post that really kind of appealed to me as a former Digg user, and in particular as a former Digg submitter, is this quote here. We care because Digg represented the messiness of the internet at its best. It showed us that out of the noise and the clutter between the lolcats and the Kim Kardashian stories, a passionate but uncoordinated group of strangers could come together to create something coherent and substantial. Alone, each of these individuals had no following, but together they were able to capture a global audience with stories that the mainstream media had mistakenly deemed unimportant.
Yep.
Digg is worth protecting, they say. So, and I agree with that. And
but is this Digg new code base?
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, it
new
is
new management, new code base. Like, what? Like, beside the name, is this really Digg? And more importantly, does it matter whether or not it's really Digg?
That's a good question. Like, I'm really anxious to see what shows up on August 1st. And they do mention that it is a work in progress, and they don't expect it to be 100%. You know, online and ready and fully engaged on August 1st, that it's just the, like, stage one, and they're actively looking for feedback from users to continue to build it. And it's a much smaller, leaner team than the original. I don't think there's anybody in there involved.
Yeah,
from
what,
the original.
What are they keeping beside the login information?
It's essentially maybe
the login, like, information and, like, the idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the big question is, I mean, I'm happy that this is happening. Digg needed a rebirth. Kevin Rose is clearly focused on other things. I want to know from you, though.
Uh-huh.
Should Reddit be worried?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think
I mean, think about it this way. Trojan War happens. Greece, the Arcadians, whatever, take down Troy. This is what Reddit did to Digg. And then Aeneas and his crew get on the boat, and they head over to this little peninsula called Italy, start a new city called Rome, and they take over everything.
Well, I don't think, I don't know. See,
that's all I'm saying. Everyone thought Greece was unstoppable until, you know,
it would be very difficult for Digg to. I feel like it would be very difficult for Digg to reach the pinnacle of success that they had before, after the, you know, it's essentially what we're talking about is a new entity that will work like Digg and happens to have Digg's name and website. But it's, other than that, there's going to be very the people aren't there. It's a matter of if they can get the users back in there. And I don't know. I mean, I'm very skeptical about their ability to attract the same users as they had before. I'm going to give it a try. I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt, and I love the enthusiasm and the idealism of their mission statement there. And we'll see. You know, we'll see August 1st when that rolls around. I'm currently banned at Reddit, so it's like I don't really have much of a choice.
What did you do to get banned at Reddit?
It was one of those things where they lumped me in with a group of other people who were legitimately spamming the site, and because the activity that they saw me doing, they perceived as also spamming, they concluded that I was one of these spammers. But I had nothing to do with any of those other people.
So are you going to call them up and be like, yo, what up, guys?
I have contacted them, and they've essentially not responded. So they're one of the thing I don't like about Reddit's, internal administration is that when it comes to user, like bans and stuff like that, they are like, shoot first and don't bother asking questions later. So essentially I'm dead to them. So, and whenever someone attempts to create a new account from the same IP, they shut that down as well. So it's like, I'm not even going to bother playing that game. So,
right.
Introduced 3 weeks ago at Google I/O 2012, the Nexus 7 with Android Jelly Bean has proven to be a runaway hit. It is already sold out at brick-and-mortar stores such as Costco, GameStop, Sam's Club, Office Depot, and Staples, and is unavailable at online stores such as B&H. Google seriously underestimated the demand for the 16-gig version, which is sold out, while the demand for the smaller 8-gig version remains comparatively low. The company has now halted further orders of the 16-gig version of the tablet on its Google Play Store. Orders made in the period up to the end of last week are due to be fulfilled, but a shortage of stock now means a hiatus in sales. The Nexus 7 appears to have been a huge hit, although Google has not yet released any figures for sales. The popularity of the 7-inch Nexus 7 has prompted speculation that Apple, which presently dominates the tablet market, will launch an iPad mini with a smaller screen than its existing 10-inch device later on this year. So we were talking about this a little bit before we started the show, that this is one of those rare cases where something is actually making Apple blink.
And right. But I want to stay away from talking about too much about Apple right now. I think Google deserves the spotlight, and I really find that. I play with the Nexus 7. I talked about it last week.
I remember you talking about this buttery back, the Asian weave.
Yeah, it's that stuff you find on the Asian devices that kind of like a that vinyl sort of leather, but not as bad as pleather backing, and it's damned good. It's light. It's fast. The battery life is really reasonable. The screen is brilliant. I mean, is it Retina? I don't know. I know that when I look at it, I like it, and it's a great device. It's hardy, and I'm a little worried that Google was like, well, it's a Nexus, so we won't make too many of them because whatever, or it costs us a little more than we thought it would, so we're going to take a little loss on it to get it out there and just like have it sold or whatever. I'm hoping that they support this device.
This is the content delivery device for Google Play, so
it is, but at the same time, like they're not set up like Amazon. Amazon made their content delivery device the Kindle Fire.
Sure.
You know, disruptive, sure. But this is that Android like rethought device that we didn't expect from Google. And I'm excited for it. I just hope that Google can Google needs to get this device in people's hands. Because that's the thing about it. People are thinking iPad. If Google can get this device in people's hands, then people will see that there is another way. I'm not saying that I don't like the iPad. I love it. I have two of them. I'm just saying that the idea is to get the device in people's hands so they can understand that there's an alternative. And really, if you're an iOS lover, that's going to kickstart Apple to getting things done in a way not unlike when iOS 3 came out and you were like, oh, they're finally fighting Android. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or iOS 5, they're finally fighting Android. That kind of thing. So I just love this competition, and I feel like I'm worried that they're going to be like, oh, we made our run. We gave a lot away to the geeks at the at Google I.O., and there was some runoff, and that's all Asus is ready to make for us. And I don't know how Asus feels about it either, because Asus is trying to sell their own tablets.
Right.
And, you know, they've got a rev share with these Google guys, and they're like, wait, what about my Transformer? What about my this? What about my that?
This is that same problem, you know, the same problem that Microsoft is experiencing with making the Surface, is that they've got that Microsoft, like Google, like Microsoft, has these corporate partners that they also have to keep engaged in their operating system. You know, Microsoft with Windows 7 and 8, and Google with Android. So they've got all of these partners that they need to keep appeased, and yet at the same time they're competing against those partners, directly competing against them with these devices.
Right. I mean, Asus was lucky to be able to make this device. Samsung still has the phone. You can still buy the phone, the Galaxy Nexus, which is a great device. But the Nexus brand has really taken off, and this is an example of how the Nexus brand is something that people want in their hands. They were smart to make this brand. Let's just hope that they're continuing to make this device, because people want it. And any iteration they make off of it, I mean, it's lightning fast with the Tegra, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, the Apple iPad 2012 has got a dual-core A5X. This thing has and it drives, you know, that thing drives like a 2048 screen by whatever.
Sure.
This thing, quad-core Tegra, made by NVIDIA. You know, the Apple iPhone iPad has a quad core graphics, but it's not a quad core chip, and it's driving this like screen that's, you know, 7 inches and doesn't have the same like need for its heavy graphic duty. So it's quite powerful. Like, you feel it; it just snaps to it, you know. But you don't even notice how fast it is, because you never have to worry about how slow it is, which is I think what Apple's fighting against right now. When I open up my calendar, it's like, okay.
Right.
My life is terrible now. While this calendar app is open, is it going to crash? Oh.
You know what's ultimately going to make the big difference for Google with the Nexus 7 is holiday sales. Like, if they don't, like, I'm not entirely
sure.
They need
to ramp up. You're saying they need to ramp up for, like, November.
Right.
So right. When that puppy gets on sale, people are like, oh, that's what's up. Well, I mean, and they really have to do that, because they have to, you know, we know. Like, I'm going to say this right now. I would be disappointed in Cupertino if I did not see a 1024x768, 7.83, 7.85 inch tablet from Apple coming out
in
October, November, when, you know, maybe right after or maybe at the same time as the sixth iPhone, whether it's called the iPhone 5 or not. And they need to drop that.
That's the big chess move right there. Is Apple going to get their pawn in place and get in the way of the Nexus 7 before the holiday
and then
time?
Then we have a real battle, right? Like, yeah, then we'll have a real, like, battle like we haven't seen since for a while. Like, just like, you know, Apple, Google, like, head to head.
And throw the Kindle
Microsoft
in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, if Microsoft wants to throw their Surface in,
yeah,
for a reasonable price,
I have, yeah.
I doubt I it, know. Though, because the Surface is going to be more than these devices.
I just read a rumor where there's a listing post on a Danish website of the Microsoft server. And you do the conversion, the U.S. conversion, and it's $1,000 for the low-end Surface.
Surface?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's over. I mean, maybe they're looking for enterprise as opposed to individual, but if Apple drops their device for $250 and Google drops their device for $200, I mean, $200, I said it last week, I'll say it again, $200 used to get you a Nook Color, which was a weak device compared to what you're able to get from Google, so... I don't want to try to, like, be Mr. Salesman for Google, but I'm excited because this device is tight.
Let's talk about Sparrow here. Now, I am unfamiliar with Sparrow. I have not used it, but
you're unfamiliar with Sparrow.
I'm unfamiliar with Sparrow.
Okay, let me give the breakdown on Sparrow.
Okay.
Sparrow, small company. They have a mail client. Works in OS X. There's one for OS. There's one for iOS as well. It's a great mail client. It talks to Google. It talks to Facebook. It talks to all these things. It's everything Apple Mail has forgotten to be. Because Apple Mail is awful, I think.
Yeah, they're a little obsolete.
Yeah, it's obsolete. It's awful. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. I had hoped that with Mountain Lion it would have been better, but it's not. It sucks. So, honestly, the best – one of the best alternatives is Outlook. But then Sparrow showed up, and Sparrow is good. The problem with Sparrow is that Google bought Sparrow. And we all know Google – is not a fan of native apps. Maybe they're trying to get into native apps. That's why they bought Sparrow, because they have native app experience on both OS X and iOS.
Why do you think, first of all, they acquired
them
for about $25 million. So that's what you think? It's an acquihire?
It's absolutely an acquihire. The only problem is they're going to discontinue support to Sparrow
nearly
immediately. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, everyone's joking how to prepare Sparrow for Google's purchase of it. Go settings, delete Sparrow, because it's not going to be updated ever again. That's the problem. So happy that Sparrow, I hate to see a good product go away, especially when you've paid for it, because it costs $10 in the Mac App Store, things like that. But I do like to see people who have made an innovative product be able to cash out. Like, I'm not going to begrudge anyone for saying, hey, I put my time in and I made a product and someone bigger than me bought it, and I can either take my energy and put it to something new, or I can retire, or I can do whatever. I mean, that's the Silicon Valley dream, you know? Not to have to worry about going public, not to do any of that stuff, just to be picked up by somebody bigger and have your product kind of live on, or maybe your talent is used for something else. Hey, Kevin Rosendig, right? So,
yeah.
I feel like I'm worried that Sparrow is going to go away forever, but I'm also pleased that they were able to, in a short time, show what's up. Just like the YouTube guys. Not quite like the YouTube guys, because that was $1.6 billion.
Yeah, they actually embraced that. Basically, they left YouTube alone, mm-hmm. and then reintegrated them into Google once they were massively entrenched. Harry McCracken, in his Technologizer post on Time, said, "Google and Facebook buy itty bitty web companies all the time, and the acquired businesses typically." Convey what's happening in an eerily consistent five-step ritual. One, announcement of thrilling acquisition. Two, reiteration of startup's wildly ambitious founding notion. Three, explanation that either Google or Facebook is the best place to change the world. Four, acknowledgement, or sometimes non-acknowledgement, that the startup's product is being discontinued or going into limbo. And five, expression of heartfelt gratitude to various supporters, usually including the consumers who are losing something they like. In case of similar snapped-up startups like Remail, BumpTop, Sage TV, Apture, Katango, Gowalla, Glancy, and now Sparrow, the stuff the startups in question had built was cool enough to intrigue Google or Facebook, but not a big enough deal to trump the acquiring company's own products and ambitions. So if the inventors of something you love tell you that they're thrilled to announce they've sold themselves to Google and Facebook, remember this: they have a reason to be thrilled. So does the company doing the buying. It might even be a happy development for users of the Google or Facebook services that the acquisition is intended to bolster. But it doesn't really matter how celebratory, thankful, or ambitious the announcement sounds. It's probably bad news for you."
Well, it can, but it can't be. I mean, there was always the outlier like Instagram, right?
Sure. Sure. Well, Instagram, I mean,
there's still, I mean, Facebook was making Facebook Camera.
Yeah.
When they bought Instagram, and they're both still up.
I think maybe the jury is still out on Instagram because of Facebook Camera, and because, I mean, are they going to allow those to continue to coexist?
Zuckerberg likes to say, I haven't heard a lot of people who buy these companies come out and say, "We're going to leave it intact." They don't say that. They don't say anything and then destroy it. Zuckerberg was like, "We're going to leave it intact. You know, we're going to let it do what it wants to do." And if they want, Instagram can become the default camera for every person. I mean, it already is the default camera for half the people I know who use it.
Yeah.
They don't take pictures on the Mac camera. They take it on Instagram.
because why not, right? So,
Another point that I thought was really interesting about this whole situation comes from David Barnard, who wrote on his App Cubby blog, "The entire software industry is changing. Computer users used to spend hundreds of dollars for great software and pay again every couple of years for upgrades. But over the past couple of decades, people have grown accustomed to getting more and more value from software while paying less and less for it. The web has played a huge part in that, but the trend was accelerated by the App Store and Apple's management of it. Sparrow is the proverbial canary in the coal mine. The age of selling software to users at a fixed one-time price is coming to an end. It's just not sustainable at the absurdly low prices users have come to expect. Sure, independent developers may scrap it out one app at a time, and some may even do quite well and be the exception to the rule, but I don't think Sparrow would have sold out if the team and their investors believe they could build a substantially profitable company on their own. The gold rush is well and truly over."
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that there are...
You think there's still room for...
I think of Marco Arment, who makes Instapaper. And Instapaper is a great product. And people, are, you know, Apple copied it, which sucks. But
well, see, that's the other thing that happens. If you don't get purchased by, you know, Google or Facebook or Apple, then you get ripped off.
But I don't think you need to. In American capitalism, there's this idea that every company must grow, right?
Yeah.
You know, expand or die, expand or be bought, I guess. But this guy, Marco Arment, has shown us, and Sparrow, I think, too, like, okay, fine. You may not get stinking ridiculously rich off of your product. But does that keep it from being successful? No. Are you living a comfortable life? The man's making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year off of this product. That's good. Like, small business is still business. And in a world of software, small business can still, you know, maintain its peace. The idea that you have to be bought by a big company or be a big company in order to deliver a quality, high-end, niche product to a group of people, especially in, like, the iOS app world. Maybe the desktop world is different, but the iOS app world... You should be able to have a suite of products that are selling for reasonable prices, that are based on good ideas and not ridiculously complex, like OpenGL algorithms that take teams and teams of people to make and make a living. Just like how independent music people can, like Pomplamoose, can make a living mm-hmm. without being Lady Gaga. You know, I feel like that's where things are going in many ways. You cut the overhead. Like Unsubscriber, I don't know if you've ever seen that, but it's like unsubscriber.info.
No.
And the system basically will log into your Gmail, and for $2, they will go into your Gmail, find all the bulk email, whether you've opted in or not, and it'll unsubscribe for you. That's a great idea.
That is a great idea.
Right? Like, that's a great idea. Is the guy going to become dazzlingly rich off of this? Maybe not. Can he make enough money to put a down payment on a house? Probably. And that's what matters, at least to me.
All right. Let us take a little break here and talk briefly about our sponsor. Our sponsor is audible.com. And for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book that I'd like to talk about this week is called Batman and Philosophy, The Dark Knight of the Soul by Mark D. White and Robert Arp. I figure this is a good tie-in because of the Dark Knight Rises opening last weekend. And essentially, this is one of those books, you know, it's like every few years when there's this iconic film or this iconic film series that comes out, people... dig into exploring it from a philosophical level. Like they did this with The Matrix. There was a lot of essays written about The Matrix, and people had collected them into these volumes about
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
There's one recently on South Park, The Philosophy of South Park. And this one is Batman. Batman is one of the most complex characters ever to appear in comic books, graphic novels, and the big screen. Batman and Philosophy explores how the Dark Knight grapples with ethical conundrums, moral responsibility, his identity crisis, and the moral weight he carries to avenge his murdered parents, and much more. So that is Batman and Philosophy, The Dark Knight of the Soul by Mark D. White and Robert Arp. And that book, amongst any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles, can be yours just for giving them a try. And to do that, to download that free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and a 30-day trial to check out the rest of their services. And even if you don't like the service at all, you still get to keep the audiobook. So there you go. We're going to take a little break here, take a little listen to some music, and when we come back, we're going to get into some more headlines, including an update on Yahoo and Marissa Meyer, and, of course, Mountain Lion. So take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down Live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm Andy Sorcini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas.
Yes, hi, Andy Sorcini.
Let's talk about... now, last week we went into great depths about Melissa Meyer.
Melissa Meyer.
And her appointment to Yahoo as their new CEO. And this week I ran across a terrific article in the New York Times by David Carr, who himself is one of my favorite reporters there. And he kind of encapsulated, like, he hit a lot of the points that we talked about, but did it in I think in a comprehensively better way. And I just wanted to read a little bit from his column here. He says, "What is Yahoo? That straightforward question has so far baffled the people who run the company. Now the question falls to Marissa Meyer, who was named the new chief executive last week. Anyone who has followed tech knows that she has remarkable credentials and savvy, but her tenure will be a pass-fail test based on answering that single question." He says, "I'm going to take a whack at it and say that Yahoo is a media company, mostly by accident. Yahoo, despite its tattered reputation, is number one in content categories, according to ComScore, including news, finance, sports, entertainment, and real estate. Yahoo reaches more than 75% of the total internet audience in the U.S. So Ms. Meyer may be taking over a stagnating company, but is not a collapsing one. Yahoo has what all media companies want, which is a large audience. The company just doesn't know what to do with it. It's possible, of course, that Ms. Meyer will choose code over content, treating news as just the skin on a technology enterprise, but in that space, Yahoo is not number one in anything. It yielded search to Google, flailed at social media, and let its messaging product languish. Even if Ms. Meyer gets the disparate parts of the content apparatus moving in concert, news presents its own problems. Yahoo has done well in display advertising by creating desktop content that's all things to all people, but the desktop is going away in favor of mobile. Taking that desktop franchise, a 10-pound bag of stuff if ever there was one, and cramming it into the 1-pound bag of mobile space will require difficult choices, which will have to be settled by asking the same question over and over. What is Yahoo?" So I think she's got a huge task ahead of her.
It's a messaging task, though. I mean, what is Yahoo? Yeah, she's got to package it up. She's got to figure out how to sell that package to people. But in the end, I've been saying this for years, Yahoo has like some powerful, powerful bits of content, one of which is Yahoo Sports. Like, a lot of geeks are like, ah, I don't care about sports, but I'm a geek who does. And Yahoo's fantasy football is fantastic. It's mobile on fantasy football is doubly fantastic. It's tablet. I don't know if you want to call that mobile or not. Is triply fantastic. So there is some stuff going on there. But I think Yahoo caters to a far more mainstream than the geeks of the world are willing to pay attention to or respect. And that's why it has so many users. But it's so stagnant for people who are into technology. So she's got to find a way to bridge the gap where the influencers, the geeks, are once again touting Yahoo's awesomeness to get even more mainstream people in there. The first time that iPhone came out in 2007, it was a piece of junk to most geeks. Didn't have anything, not even 3G. But now, you know, geeks have embraced it. And so regular people have embraced it too. It's the same thing with Macs. And I think that's how it is with Google. And Yahoo needs to get back there. Instead of just getting the mainstream, they have to get the geeks a little bit too, so they could tout it, so they could push it. They need to push the envelope forward. They've been aggregating content, but that's not really a tech thing. And Marissa Mayer is a tech woman.
Right.
I guess we'll find out if she is or not. Maybe she doesn't care about being a tech woman. Maybe it's enough for her to being able to push the current product and repackage it in a way that's cohesive. But I don't think that's the case. So we'll see what happens.
I know who does care what Marissa Mayer does with the company, and that is Yahoo's employees. There are posters hanging on the walls of Yahoo's Sunnyvale headquarters.
Well, screw those guys. It's the shareholders.
Well, of course, yes. They put up posters of her in the style of Shepard Fairey's iconic Hope poster for Obama, but done in shades of purple, which is Yahoo's signature color. And like those Obama posters, it also has Marissa Mayer's face on it and says Hope underneath it, which speaks to what we're hearing about Mayer being received by Yahoo's troops. So there's a lot of hope riding on her. I think, you know, basically the bottom line is everybody wants this to work out well for Yahoo. I think users do, the employees obviously do, shareholders obviously do. You know, this is Yahoo's last stand. And so we're going to see. We'll see how she handles it.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on here. Now, Apple this morning released Mountain Lion, the next version of the Mac OS operating system, as a $19.99 upgrade in the Mac App Store. Many of the most attention-grabbing features will be familiar to iPad and iPhone users, including a new Notification Center and Game Center, in addition to Twitter integration.
Not to mention Notes, if you use Notes on your iOS, or if you have Reminders enabled on your iOS device, you get that stuff too. The big question is it going to screw up the independent stuff on your Mac?
Well, I already know, like, Growl right off the bat is going to be replaced by the a Notification Center, or if not replace, I mean, I don't need both of them.
Well, it depends. Right now, most of the apps that you have for OS X, are running with an API tie-in into Growl, whereas they don't have API tie-ins to Mountain Lion. They'll probably get them, but you're going to have to install Growl if you want to maintain that functionality while they roll over and hold on to that. So, It's not as seamless as just saying, oh, I'm going to switch one for the other.
I like Growl, but I've always been annoyed by the fact that when its little banner comes up, it kind of gets in the way of whatever you've got going on underneath it. And you can't, like, every time you roll over it, it pulls focus to the banner. You can't just make it go away. So.
Mine is all right. I don't have that problem. It's showing up on the upper right-hand corner of the screen. Some of it getting in the way, lots of stuff. I'm in good shape. Although it was unstable when it came to IVI. So, I don't know. I have yet to be, I mean, I've seen the articles about it, but I've yet to be able to find OS X Lion server.
Did you?
Mountain Lion server. So I think, like, maybe I have to download Mountain Lion first and then go get server. But I'm running an OS X Lion server, so I'd like to wait until that comes out.
Speaking of articles about OS X, did you see Ars Technica's 24-page article reviewing Mountain Lion?
Yeah, I was surprised that it was you know, it was you know, I wasn't surprised because it's ours and that's what they do.
And it's John.
I mean,
Syracuse.
They have the 20-page iPhone 4S review,
right?
Like, that's what they do.
Yeah.
So they probably went over all 200, you know, new features. Like, six of them are like only for Chinese speakers. Some of them are like Safari checks for software updates every day. You know. This is the new file system and all that crap. There's stuff that you don't care about as a normal user. So,
when you have to write a separate article apologizing for how long the first article is and just giving you like a summary of the first article, then you know that you're approaching overkill on a review. Actually, I'm really glad that ours does this.
I'm sad that they had to publish the apology.
Yeah.
Right, like, you are a geek site.
Right. Yeah, like, the apology went to the effect of, as many are already reading John Syracuse's massive 26,000-word review of the operating system, but what if you have to actually get work done today and you don't have time yet
to spend
hours?
You can download the ebook or PDF.
I heard they actually had problems with publishing the ebook for some reason.
Yeah, because they made it, like, today.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And I am going to check that. I flipped through the 24-page article, and I'm going to go through it in depth. And that'll be kind of like the manual that didn't come with the Mountain Lion that I'll read. So so there we go. Okay, so moving on here. Now, we had this next story we had planned to talk about a while back, and we dropped it, but it has come back up in the news again. So now is our opportunity to discuss it again. And that is about the new dock. So the iPhone 5, Apple's next generation.
Wait. We don't know what it's called. All we know is it is the sixth iPhone.
Okay. Apple's next generation iPhone, we'll just call it that, expected to go on sale around October, will come with a 19-pin connector port at the bottom instead of the proprietary 30-pin port to make room for the earphone moving down to the bottom. The reasons for the new smaller dock connector: Apple needs additional space inside the iPhone casing to fit an LTE chipset.
And it's freaking 10 years old and works on USB 2.0.
Right. It means that these new phones are not going to connect with all of the current accessories, such as speakers and power chargers that form part of the ecosystem around iPods, iPads, and iPhones without an adapter.
This includes the Elevation Dock, a Kickstarter that was huge because it allowed you to dock your iPhone, regardless of the size of the case or whatever, in a secure way. That dock with the new iPhone will not work without some sort of adapter.
Right. Now, a London-based analyst at technology research firm Canalys says this represents an opportunity for accessories vendors. iPad docking speaker sales have been declining for 1 or 2 years. Apple needs to find a solution not to disappoint their current clients who want to upgrade to the new iPhone but are tied to an expensive accessory that they've bought. Like, for example, what about all those dock connectors that are built into cars? You know, like the BMWs and such.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know about BMW having a built-in dock. I know BMW does, but they also have, like, you know, you can always Bluetooth into it, so you don't necessarily have to dock connect. I don't know. The way I look at it, when we saw the Retina MacBook Pro come out, there was a MagSafe power dock adapter for $10. There will be one. I'll say it right now. There will be one for legacy iOS devices to connect with
you know, accessories to connect with this new iOS device.
Well, the site iMore.com reached out to sources that claim, yes, there will be an adapter for the smaller dock connector that will let it work with the many of the accessories.
It doesn't even matter if Apple made it or not. Like, someone was going to make it. The market is just too large. For the last 9 years, we've been using the 30-pin dock connector. Maybe 10 years. No, yeah, 2002 to now. 10 years, we've been using the 30-pin dock connector. There, the invisible hand of the economy says someone has to make it.
Sure, sure, sure. I think there's no currently there's no report whether or not one will be included in the box along with the new iPhone or sold separately.
Of course not. $10.
Yeah.
$10. I mean, like, why would they do that when they can make, you know,
$10?
How much is they're going to make basically $9.99 to make it. I mean, they were selling, this is the same company that in 2010 sold a bumper case for $30.
Right. Right.
That literally costs like 50 cents to make.
Right, right. I got my case at that same time. It wasn't a bumper case. And just this last week, for the first time ever, I cracked the phone, the glass on my iPhone. So I'm anxiously awaiting that new iPhone.
Wow, how did you do that? I've had an iPhone for years.
Well,
and I've
here's the irony, the sad, the hand of fate that laughs at me is that I had this polycarbonate case for a long time, like ever since I got the phone. And I dropped it a couple times, and the polycarbonate actually chipped in one corner and left like part of the iPhone exposed, a small part. And then I dropped it again within the last week, and it happened to fall right on that exposed part, and that's where the glass cracked. So if I'd gotten a replacement,
yeah, you gotta replace it. Also, you gotta get the whole, like, I don't know, for me the phone has glass on both sides, so I got the case that's soft on the inside, hard on the outside. It's a double layer thing. It's made by iFrogs. You know, it's just gonna absorb that shock, and it has the little lip in the front. So it shouldn't fall flat on its front face. It'll be fine. But I'm also the kind of guy, I have like three cases. I have an OtterBox for when I ski.
Oh, nice.
I have the battery case for when I travel. And I have the normal case for every day.
So. I mean, it's not the end of the world. The crack does not go into the screen part at all. So, and I had always intended that I wasn't going to resell this when it reached the end of its life, that I was going to hand it down to my daughter. So
as an iPod Touch kind of thing?
Yeah. As an iPod yeah, basically because it's got all the cool apps on it that she likes to use. So
yeah. I mean, I also collect them.
Uh huh.
I think I have all the iPhones except for the iPhone 4, and I have a G1.
So you don't resell them at all?
No. I think that they are a seminal moment in technology, just like the G1 and the Nexus One and the Nexus S, which I also have kind of lying around. I think these are pieces that I like to keep intact and around. I actually still use the 3GS for remote control for my Apple TV. So
nice.
I have the third generation Apple TV. I was uninterested in it before this generation.
Nice.
But I kind of want to go back and get the first and second generation Apple TVs just for my little museum.
I'd like to get some sort of really useful, like, I don't have Apple TV, but I'd like to get I know that they're out there, these remote control apps that, universal remote control apps that let you use your iPhone as a remote control for...
You need a IR blaster for some of your devices. A big thing to look at is Logitech has, like, this iLink thing or whatever. You can use your iPad. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I was looking at that, but I never want to use my iPad. Because I use my iPad actually to watch the stuff. And it always takes a moment to reacquire... And all other stuff like that. So I still do find myself using an IR remote, and the Harmony One is pretty much the best thing you can get for, you know, it'll convert the audio to the right channel when you choose the device you want, all that stuff. You know, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant device.
I have that Harmony, not the One, but it's like the 900, I think it is.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll spend 3 hours programming it exactly right.
Yeah.
But it's totally worth it, because the idea is that you want it so that the person in your house who's not a techie, in my case, my beautiful, loving girlfriend, doesn't ever have to. She can just, like, I'm choosing to watch Netflix now. And she doesn't have to think about what she's choosing.
selecting audio and video sources, etc.
Yeah, I have the 900, and I've got it all programmed and everything, but I can't get my family to use it in any case because they're afraid of technology. So
your family is afraid of technology.
Yeah, ironically enough, yes.
That's the way I'm going to.
Well, because nothing, you know, the thing is, in the irony about the Harmony, and this is getting off on a tangent here, but I might as well, is that it works 99% perfectly, and it's that 1% that doesn't quite work right that scares everyone away. Like, you know, sometimes when you turn everything off, everything doesn't turn off. And I think it's a matter of...
It's actually a matter of holding it and pointing it at it until everything turns off, because that's to send the signal separately. But no non-geek realizes that. My girlfriend is one of these people. And she breaks things all the time because she doesn't actually pay attention to how to use them properly. So,
right.
That. What's interesting to think, though, is that you can get the Harmony remote right now, the Harmony 1, or rather the Harmony 900, for $164. And then if you want, that's just a point-and-shoot remote with all this programming. You can spend $160, $4 less, to get the Harmony 1100 Super Universal Remote Control Pad amazing touchscreen thing. So
right. And, you know, the thing about that one that I'm not crazy about is the form factor. Like,
yeah, I don't want two hands to change.
Exactly. I mean, come on. we've been raised from children that a remote is a particular size and shape, and it's handheld, and it's in one hand. It's the clicker, and it's like an innate...
It's tactile. That's the problem with using the 3GS as a remote control. Like, with Boxy, at least the remote control, the application remote control, is swipe-focused. You know, same with, like, a Plex. You can swipe, and that's intuitive because you don't have to look at it. But the whole looking for buttons when it's a glass screen doesn't work. So I still enjoy the Boxy remote the best. The one with the QWERTY keyboard in the back.
I'm not familiar with that, but I'm going to look it up right now.
Oh, it's so... You can buy for OS X, or you can buy for Windows. And it's got...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm looking at it
right
now.
You know, it's basically like the Apple remote, but on the back, you flip it over, it's got a QWERTY keyboard that's ready to go. No matter what's going on,
it's got a very simple front face and the keyboard on the back.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
If only they can make it work for the Apple TV.
It looks like it's got all the controls to do so, just not coordinated to do so, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
We've got one last story here to talk about before we wrap things up. And that is Apple and versus Samsung, another chapter in the great Apple versus Samsung war. Apple is looking for Samsung to fork over $2.5 billion to settle patent infringement claims in the U.S. And that's the latest figure bandied about by Apple in the ongoing patent infringement saga between the two companies. But how did Apple cook up such a figure? The amount is based on the per-unit royalties that Apple believes it is due from Samsung as part of the intellectual property rights lawsuit. Drilling down the price tag per unit, $2.02 covers the over-scroll bounce technology cited in the patent. That technology lets users know when they've reached the bottom of the screen or list by responding with a bounce. Another $3.10 covers the scrolling API technology from another patent. Another $2.02 is for the tap to zoom and navigate feature from yet another patent. And finally, $24 covers the use of any of Apple's design patents or trade dress rights. Overall, that means the damages cover both design and technology, but the bulk of the $2.5 billion is more about design. So,
that's what it comes down to. Like, it's the design. Like, they... When you look at the freaking, like, connector,
yeah,
it's clearly a copy. Like, I mean, I wish Chris were on here. He always avoids these particular episodes, I imagine. But I feel like, like, it's one thing to say the software. It's something to say, I built my hardware to look like your hardware because I think that people like your hardware, and I'm going to copy your hardware in order to make sure that people confuse your hardware with my hardware. That's kind of...
But there's something that makes me feel like design should not be patentable, right?
No. It's called trade dress. It's different. It's a different... It's not a patent. It's an intellectual property problem, but it's not a patent problem. And when I make my stuff look a certain way, you can't make your stuff look the same way because it causes customer confusion.
Sure.
It's a bigger deal than... I think it's a bigger deal than patents because you can get... You can find a million ways to get software to do something. Just like you can find a million ways to get pharmaceuticals to do something. But the way something looks is an easy, copyable thing that you can use to confuse people. That's why when people download Scareware, how do they do that? Because someone has a little web page, a little widget that looks like the Microsoft Windows scanning tool. And you're like, oh, my shit's being scanned. I better click here and get this done. You know, like it's confusing to the user.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. Like, you shouldn't confuse the user. You shouldn't try to trick the user. And I work in advertising, and I know that, you know? So if I'm saying it, then Samsung, big old Samsung, shouldn't be making the dock connectors the same, the plugs the same, the icon layout the exact same. I mean, you know what I mean? It's weird.
Right. But at the same time, I feel like that is – you're right. That is definitely a trade dress issue, but it shouldn't be – it shouldn't be involved in a patent suit.
Well, these are intellectual property disputes. I think that they're using the word patent a little loosely here. I think that they're, you know, yo, it's $2.5 billion in damages. Scrolling API technology, call that a patent. Tap to zoom, that's a patent, right? But when it comes to the other stuff, that's more of like the trademark, the trade dress, all that stuff. So... I think that's a different story. So, yeah. These aren't, I mean, like, you know, a grid of icons, a wall of icons. I don't know if there's a patent for a wall of icons. I mean, then everybody would be suing everybody else. Oh,
and
wait,
some things like the, you know, like the slide to unlock.
That's a patent.
Yeah,
that took
to me feels like a design.
That took a considerable amount of engineering to figure that out. And someone figured out that. That slide to unlock, what they're doing there is making it so that the user's making a deliberate decision to unlock the screen without the use of a button. So I see the patent in that. But when it comes to the trademark, the trade dress, that's kind of about how things are laid out. And that's what we're seeing here, like the wall of icons, the dock at the bottom. Those aren't things that are necessarily patented, but they're like, because it's not a question of like how you're getting it done. It's just a question of the fact that you're copying someone else and it causes confusion.
Let me ask you, Dwayne, where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Twitter.com/Dwayne D, DWAYNED. Flavors.me/Dwayne D. You can also hopefully find some of my writing on the Intermundo Media blog when you have a chance. That'll be up fairly soon. Copyright is going through right now.
Are you
going
to be getting a dig.com account when they launch on August 1st?
I don't know. I mean, I already have a dig.com account, and
well,
they'll honor those.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
But I don't know if I'll be hopping on Dig. Haven't been on Dig in some time. Devinger got a start on Dig. He'd like email. I have emails. Dude, I got 60,000 hits on Dig today because of this article I wrote about whatever. You know, like he. You know, that's how he started off.
A lot of people got their start on Dig. All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, G+.to. MrBabyMan is my Google Plus account where I've got all my social links. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. You subscribe to us on iTunes, go to geeksofdoom.com, and we're in the upper right-hand sidebar. And that link goes directly to our iTunes subscription page. Our show is on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Find Stitcher in your App Store or at Stitcher.com, Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
See you later. Thanks.